The Vietnam War, it's over. Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
When it comes to weight loss, no two people are the same. That's why Noom builds personalized plans based on your unique psychology and biology. Take Brittany. After years of unsustainable diets, Noom helped her lose 20 pounds and keep it off.
I was definitely in a yo-yo cycle for years of just losing weight, gaining weight, and it was exhausting.
And Stephanie. She's a former D1 athlete who knew she couldn't out-train her diet, and she lost 38 pounds.
My relationship to food before Noom was never consistent.
And Evan, he can't stand salads, but he still lost 50 pounds with Noom.
I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. Even through the pickiness, Noom taught me that building better habits builds a healthier lifestyle. I'm not doing this to get to a number. I'm doing this to feel better.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom users compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
The XX Gab Fest is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audiblepodcast.com/XX.
Welcome to the XX Gabfest for Thursday, October 31st, the Juice Cleanse edition. If you're listening today, it's Halloween.
Ooh.
Let's hope none of you are dressing up as a sexy witch or a slutty waitress. If you're, you know, let's say if you're 30 and above, how's that? You have to wear a dignified costume. Is that like a rule or no?
Ageist.
No?
That's so no. Ageist.
That's no. So ageist? Oh, okay. Yeah. So even I can be a sexy witch?
Yeah.
I forgot to say my name. I'm Hannah Rosen, editor of XX. I'm joined in New York by June Thomas. Hi, June.
Hello, Hannah.
And Noreen Malone of The New Republic. Hi, Noreen.
Hey, Hannah.
You know, I'm flying to Australia this afternoon. I have since learned that we have fans in Australia, which is lovely. Hi, all you fans in Australia. I am terrified.
G'day.
I'm terrified for two reasons. One is because I'm on the other side of the world from my children, literally. Like, if you look on a globe, I am literally exactly on the other side of the world. And two, because it's like the longest flight ever. It's like 20 hours. And I miss Thursday. Like, Thursday's just not there in my space-time continuum. It's gone. And that's Halloween. So my daughter suggested I dress up like a witch and pass out candy on the plane. Is that a good idea or a bad idea?
She's trying to embarrass you.
Yeah.
Oh, really? Happening.
Way
yeah.
to go.
Which is like a weird reversal of what teenagers usually do, which is what they want. They don't want their parents to embarrass them.
But if they're not there,
if they're not there.
That's true.
Yeah. So she's playing a prank on me. So I would have dressed up like a sexy witch on the plane and embarrassed
myself. Actually like kind of a vibe that's in general for winter is sexy witch. You just want to kind of like put that out there all the time.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I'll just, you know, sexy witch it up forever. Okay. Even past Halloween. All right. Our three topics today. First, rape victims speaking out. For a long time, the conventional wisdom was that we should protect the identity of victims of rape, assault, or abduction. Now a few are starting to speak out. What are the consequences of that? Second, juice cleanses. Many of us have tried them. Some of us swear by them, that they make us healthier, more focused, more spiritual, whatever. Does this have any basis at all in science? And our third topic today is the rise of the lady business travelers and what new problem she presents to the travel industry. Okay, let's start our first topic. It has long been a taboo in the press against using rape victims' names, and in the 90s, the Violence Against Women Act enshrined this as a feminist principle. The idea behind it was to protect the victim from being shamed, from having her sexual history used against her at trial. But many people thought the anonymity just enshrined the idea that rape was something so shameful that it couldn't be discussed in public. Now a few victims are speaking out. Daisy Coleman, the 14-year-old at the center of the Maryville, Missouri case, who came up in our discussion in the last podcast, has since written an essay in XO Jane in which she said, "I'm nothing more than just human, but I also refuse to be a victim of cruelty any longer. That is why I'm saying my name." And Elizabeth Smart, who was kidnapped and held for 9 months when she was 14, was the subject of a very moving profile in The New Yorker, where she told Margaret Talbot, who is a friend of mine, that her goal is to make talking about rape and abuse not such a taboo. Noreen, I'll start with you. I have extremely strong feelings about this, which I will keep to myself until I let somebody else talk. When you read Daisy Coleman's XO Jane essay, what was your immediate reaction to it?
I was sort of shocked. It's not so much that she came forward. I think it's that she's so young and she came forward. And that is one thing that all of these girls share, is that they are pretty young teenagers. There were pictures accompanying the XO Jane article of her, you know, in her cheerleading outfit, and she's looking so young. And part of it was just this visceral thing that, like, it broke my heart all over again what happened to her. But also, she's obviously been shaped by awful life experiences. But thinking back to myself at 14, I don't think I would have been able to do that. And I wonder what it is about these girls of this generation who seem to be able to do this in a way that women didn't 10 years ago.
Yeah. June, did you read that one? What did you think about that one?
I did. I mean,
one of them.
I share Noreen's response to the Daisy Coleman piece. The text was a little strange, but that's irrelevant. It almost didn't matter what it said. It's just the fact that she was out there in those pictures, those photographs of, mm-hmm. like, in her cheerleading outfit. She really just seemed so young. And again, it just really hit home, that tragedy. The problem that I have, though, and it's something that doesn't just pertain to rape stories, is just the internet and just our globalized culture and really the Googleification of journalism and information has made everything so discoverable. I don't know if this has happened to either of you guys, but just other stories, nothing to do with any, you know, anything as sensitive as rape, but people whose lives have changed or whose opinions have changed will sometimes write into a magazine and say, "I don't feel that way anymore," or "My life has changed. I've changed my life. Can you take my name out?" Because they don't want to be associated with something that was true 10, 15 years ago, but is now forever associated with their name. Generally, we say no, because, you know, the record is out there. But there aren't any backsies, is I guess what I'm trying to say. And I just kind of, I know that it's condescending. I know that it's patronizing, but I worry that she can't take that back now that it's out there. But then again, the fact that the kids who were, you know, talking smack about her, which is an underestimate of the horrible sort of discussion that was going on, that was out there too. You know, something that somebody posts on Facebook is out there. There's no sort of no privacy anymore. And so I just worry that names get sullied, that when lives change, that's always going to be there.
But how is
so? She'll be forever Daisy Coleman, the rape victim. Like, she'll be, you know, 35 years old. She'll be looking for a job. Someone will Google her name. That's what you mean?
Yeah, that's what
always
I mean.
Be, yeah.
But
yeah.
Don't you think, like, she always will be?
Yeah.
You know, like,
no,
she
absolutely.
Just, she, like, psychologically, that will always be something she'll have with her. And, you know, maybe it was an important thing for her to get over. I mean, I actually don't know how I feel about this. My first instinct is to applaud it. But then, I mean, the internet is like a hard place to be writing when you are someone not writing about your rape when you're a lot older. Like, there are just people beat you up on it, right? And and when you're sort of younger and writing about something so emotionally charged, I can't even imagine, you know?
I did find it interesting that XO Jane turned off comments on that piece. And but that was interesting.
I wonder how that piece found its way to XO Jane, which is sort of my own weird media criticism. But they run just some really bizarre stuff. Like, I wonder if they reached out, because it doesn't seem like a natural place for a teenager to think about sending, you know, her thing. And if they did reach out, what do we think about that? Do we think that's sort of predatory? Not predatory. That's not the right word. But, like, you know, exploitative, maybe.
That's a good point, because they do run some things that are really moving and other things that you feel like are really weird and you wish they hadn't let the person run that essay. It does seem to me like a natural place for it. There really isn't another place like that column, which is the "it happened to me" column, in which you just get to say what happened to you. You know, like maybe at her age she's reading Jezebel or something, but like you wouldn't want to put it in Jezebel necessarily. That would feel more exploitative and like everyone would jump on it, where that column, "it happened to me," is like explicitly held out as like a safe space for women to talk about their experiences. So I feel like that was a pretty good place. Can I say my strong feelings about this?
Please. Yes.
So I was very influenced when I was a young journalist by this essay that Joan Didion wrote in 1991 called Sentimental Journeys, about the Central Park jogger case. And I think I made you all read it, right?
Mm-hmm.
They did get
yeah.
that included
Thank you.
In our
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank
links
you for making
this week.
It.
And I just remember it was so counterintuitive, right? We all had the sense that we had to protect the Central Park rape victim. It was just like a given that we would never, ever, ever say her name, that even the New York press, which is so aggressive and predatory, would never, ever speak her name out loud. And then Joan Didion writes this absolutely brilliant essay explaining the problem with that. Well, I'm just going to read a few words of this essay. The convention of keeping the secret assumes, by providing a protection for victims of rape not afforded victims of other assaults, that rape involves a violation absent from other kinds of assault. The convention assumes that this violation is of a nature best kept secret, that the rape victim feels and would feel still more strongly were she identified a shame and self-loathing unique to this form of assault. So in other words, what she's saying is we are then adapting the kind of male idea or the rapist idea that this is such a terrible, shameful violation, and kind of reinforcing the idea that it's a terrible, shameful violation by keeping her name secret, that there's something very 19th century and protective, and the word she uses is self-fulfilling. So we're just kind of enhancing and protecting the definition of rape and why it makes you explicitly vulnerable. And it was really eye-opening for me. So when I read that XO Jane essay, at first I was kind of, I have to admit, like put off by it because of the pictures of her. Like it mm-hmm. opens with a picture of her, which is such a glamour shot. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like something about the particular way that she looks, right? So the opening, I mean, she's like angelic looking. I mean, she's really quite beautiful. So it felt weird to me somehow. But then you scroll down the pictures and then she's just like a normal girl in a top knot wearing sweatpants with her mom, with her puppy, with her girlfriends and her cheerleading uniform. All those pictures sunk in over the course of the week, and combined with the Elizabeth Smart story, which I just thought was fantastic. Like, I have so much admiration for Elizabeth Smart. And like a week later, I just could not be more moved with how brave it was for both of them to take this position. Like, you're right, June. Like, it is going to be associated with her for the rest of her life, but somebody's got to do this. Mm-hmm. Like, somebody's got to be the pioneer and speak out. And the result in this case was, instead of being the subject of like little rumors in her little town in which everybody was destroying her because, you know, some particular jocks happened to have power, suddenly she goes public in a national way, and then she's got like the whole nation on her side, right? Like, if you take it out of these little towns, mostly everybody's on her team, right? It's only in these weird little jockocracy configurations that people turn against the girl. Like, in the world at large, people don't really turn against the girl. And so suddenly she's got the support of everyone, and the prosecutors have to reopen the case. So I just think it was fantastic. I mean, we haven't even gotten to Elizabeth Smart and like all her incredibly brave and interesting ideas about victimhood in abduction cases, which we can talk about when I stop talking, which will be very soon.
So, Hannah, okay. You've got me mostly convinced. And the Joan Didion essay really is fantastic, and it's about a lot more than just this one rape. It's if you're interested in like New York City and race relations and all that stuff, like read it. But one thing about this essay and the pictures is that in the Didion essay, she writes about how, you know, this woman was the perfect victim. Mm-hmm. She embodied a certain idea of what New York in the 80s wanted itself to be. She was this hard-charging Wall Street nice girl from a great background, right? And so then when you read the XO Jane essay, something about the pictures makes me feel like this girl is, she's grabbing control of the narrative back, right? But she is sort of grabbing control of the narrative back in a way that says I was the perfect victim, right? And that
right.
is her story, and that's like who she is. But if there are a few women who are held up this way, and you feel like you can only come forward if your story is, you know, this kind of story, and you're a blonde cheerleader, like that's a little complicated.
Right. I see. Like, if you weren't a blonde cheerleader, you know, if you weren't 14 years old and there with a 13-year-old friend, you know,
yeah. If you had a little bit more of a checkered past or whatever.
And everything about Daisy Coleman's story, I mean, the fact that she was in the car when her father was killed. And, you know, I mean, just the there's so many levels of this life, this story that, it's not typical and shouldn't be like unique. I agree with you, Noreen, that you shouldn't, like, you have to be just like this or else you don't. Which, even though nobody's saying that explicitly,
but,
it does feel like we're setting up a kind of loop. This is what you need to do to turn things around, because then what happens if people don't sympathize, if people still...
Right, if you're not a mediagenic rape victim.
Yeah.
But then that being said, like, maybe someone like this opens the door for other people to feel like they can express their own.
Well, that's how I feel. Like, two things about that. One is what you just said. In other words, when you're taking a gay marriage case to the Supreme Court, you know, you're going to pick a lesbian couple who's been together for 200 years and shares property and is very, like, photogenic and wonderful and well-spoken, right? Like, that's who you're going to pick, right? So I think that's fairly typical, is that it's the people who win our sympathy who kind of turn the tide, because Elizabeth Smart is the same. I mean, they look like older sister and younger sister, weirdly. Like, they're very similar looking. They're both, like, beautiful, wholesome girls. You know, they were, like, this thing happened to them at the exact same age, 14, which we all feel protective of a 14-year-old, right? It would be, almost be different if she were 18 or 19, but 14 is still, like, a child. So there's something interesting in the fact that they both end up being the ones who turn the tide, if they do turn the tide, which I hope they do. And the second thing I want to say about this is, you're right, but the thing that struck me about all those photographs is that, you know, Joan Didion writes about how anonymity allowed us to overlay all of our ideas about victimhood and rape and New York City and the kind of rising bourgeois class and female empowerment on a story, because we had no person. Whereas with Daisy Coleman, what it does is give you specificity. Like, this is a human being. This isn't some generic case. This is like a person with a past and a puppy and a mother and a father who died. So it's specific. It's not like you can't now continue to say Daisy Coleman or X or Y. One thing Elizabeth Smart does is push back against all these narratives that we have written about abduction and rape, which are so strong, like we can't seem to get away from them. Like, they get repeated in every single story. She says, you know, I am not a permanent victim. I am not ruined by this. You know, there is no such thing as Stockholm syndrome. You know, it is not true that I identified with captors. It's only true that I was, like, really, really scared. Don't think that you would have done anything differently. Don't ever judge anyone in this situation. You have no idea what you would have done if you were 14 years old and stuck with this guy, right? So, like, we can no longer say the things we always say about abduction victims and rape victims, because she's telling us to shut up. Like, she's telling us about a specificity of experience that's not the big rape narrative. I loved it. I thought I'm so admiring of Elizabeth Smart. I think it's, like, amazing. You know, even the way she handled Nancy Grace, like, shut up, Nancy, you know, Nancy, who's, like, the worst, and kind of overlaying her, like, maudlin nonsense on any person who comes on her show. She was just amazing.
I mean, I do still hope very much that this is a choice by the women. I mean, especially for these young women. Again, I keep coming back to this. The world is now, you know, everything is discoverable. You know, you remember back in the DSK case and the Dominique Strauss-Kahn case, where, you know, the French newspapers used the name of the accuser, because that is what is done in France. And then that caused sort of issues here, because then, of course, why would you not hear if the name is out there in another country?
And then she was smeared. She
right,
was
exactly.
She was first built up as this, you know, hardworking immigrant mother, and then all of a sudden in the Post she was a prostitute, right? Like, so that was sort of, I mean, again, and she, as you're probably about to say, and I'm stealing the words out of your mouth, she didn't get to control that narrative herself.
Right. The Joan Didion piece was excellent about how anonymity can lead to abstraction, but it also made the point that we each project our own thing onto that anonymous screen. And so that, you know, the different communities in New York City at that time did not all project the same thing onto the victim. And as we now know, you know, however many years later, decades later, that case was all messed up in so many ways. And
they were false, right?
Right,
they were
false,
but they penned the wrong guys. Right.
The convictions were later vacated. I mean, those men spent many years in jail, you know, with no basis. So there are so many dangers, and I just don't want it to be compulsory for women to come forward and for their names to be out there. If they want to, then I agree, it can be extremely empowering, I think, but I just don't want it to be another set of rules that people have to you know, okay.
You know, the DSK case was an interesting one to bring in, actually. That does give me pause because she was a different social class, right? Like,
yes.
She did not have the power to control her media narrative. She would not have known to call Exo Jane. She wouldn't have written a book, you know? So I guess that is an example of a situation where putting your name out there can do exactly what the Violence Against Women's Act was worried about, which is, you know, now suddenly people can say anything they want about you because you don't have the power to fight back.
Right. Yeah. And I worry, like, if it becomes expected of people, because it's so hard to get people to report rapes anyway. Mm-hmm. And then if there's this whole thing where you think that potentially you're going to be, you know, marched in front of people as like a, you're going to have to do PR work on your rape. Like, that's awful. That's awful to think about having to do that.
Okay. All right. Let's move on to our second topic, which is juicing. I'm drinking a juice right now. No, I'm not. But before we do that, I want to thank our sponsor, Audible.com, our loyal sponsor. Audible offers over 100,000 audiobooks, as well as almost any form of chatter available on the internet. And you can listen to them on practically any device, including the one you're listening to us on right now. For XX listeners who aren't Audible members, they offer a free audiobook of your choice when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at our special URL, audiblepodcast.com/XX. Not XX, but XX. The book I'm going to recommend this week is Joan Didion Slouching Toward Bethlehem. I've been in a Joan Didion reading phase, and I have completely opposite reactions, which is like to her reported pieces. I feel like they're kind of overwrought and overdetermined and kind of overwritten. But to her essays, I feel like they're so unbelievably prescient and brilliant and brave. So I'm having a Joan Didion moment. Anyway, that particular book on Audible is narrated by Diane Keaton, so it's extra cool to listen to. Your membership includes a free subscription to either The Times, The Wall Street Journal. So give it a try today, and please use our URL, audiblepodcast.com/XX.
Wait, I want to talk about Diane Keaton as the voice of Joan Didion's inner monologue. I'm not sure how I feel about that. I don't know. That's just not what I picture Joan Didion's inner, like, I love Diane Keaton, but she's a little like ditzy, like charming ditzy. And that's not.
Except that she is at heart a California girl.
True.
And they do kind of have a similar look even. They're probably even, I know Diane Keaton's probably a little younger, but they don't sound that out of sync to me.
But it's funny, Slouching Toward Bethlehem has this like mood of fear in it.
Yes. You know,
like
70s,
kind of the center is not holding kind of 70s trepidation. And you wonder if Diane Keaton can pull that off or if she's not quite believable in that, you know, in that mood.
Got to download and find out.
Okay, download and find out. That can be something our listeners tell us. Okay, juicing. These days, if you're upwardly mobile, have hipster bourgeois aspirations, live in New York, San Francisco, or if you are a celebrity, say Gwyneth Paltrow, chances are you juice. Juice, according to its acolytes, will make you healthier, make your skin glow, and possibly lead to transcendence. Vanessa Gregoriadis, who really is just such a fabulous writer.
So good.
She's so good. Like, she's so good at these kind of upper class anthropologies, you know? I mean, she's just like, she really just hits, she gets it right. And she's kind of it, but not quite. You know, she has like enough ironic distance, but enough participation to pull these things off so well. Mm-hmm. Anyway, she writes, juice cleansing is as much of a mantra today as white bread is the devil or Michael Pollan's eat food, not too much, mostly plants. It's just become the next thing we all talk about. So I will speak about my own juice experience shortly, but I will ask you guys first, have either of you seriously juiced?
I'm not much of a juicer. In the past, at other times in my life, I have done cleanses which involved a lot of basically living off juice for a couple of weeks.
So talk about that. Was it like transformation? I mean, Vanessa, she says that, you know, once upon a time she did this kind of, you know, before juicing was mainstream, she did this, you know, she went off to what is, you know, the equivalent of ashram, juice equivalent of an ashram,
right,
and actually did have this kind of off the beaten path transformational experience in which she emerged as not herself anymore. And that she, like, you know, lifted off a lot of old baggage that she was carrying. Like, it was really like the way people talk about, you know, deep yogic experiences.
Right.
So what did you have that, June? Maybe you were like Irish before you did the juice?
I'm looking at Noreen. I wasn't Noreen, honestly.
You were straight? You were straight?
It didn't transform me that much, Hannah.
Right.
But it was like, I did it more than once because it really did give me a lot of energy and it really did offer some kind of, there's a lot of ironic distance in what I'm about to say, it did offer some kind of liberation. It's nice to be free from any concerns except just like, how are you feeling? You're not like, you just let so much go. And when you spend a week just living on apple juice, all you can think about is, oh my God, I can't believe how much energy I have for only eating apple juice. The ones that I did, I'm not going to go into details because it's slightly gross and personal, but it used to conclude with with an enema. Oh. And naturally, being English, I did enjoy that.
The cayenne pepper one?
No, it was one, though, that at the end, after turning your body into a temple, that you then drank a quarter cup of olive oil before going to bed.
Oh my God!
To produce gallstones, I used to keep them in the freezer for many years, and then
did you sleep on the bathroom floor? Like...
Well, I'm not going to go into detail, but anyway, it's a little challenging to the system. However,
well, I don't understand. Like, why does that make you feel? What is it exactly that leads to the transcendence? The fact of the ritual, like the regularity in the ritual, the not indulging in food, like which part of it is the kind of freeing part? What's freeing about that?
I don't know the answer to what does it, but I mean, to me, I would say it's discipline. I think of myself, even though actually it's not true, but especially back then, I felt myself to lack discipline. And though, mm-hmm. so it was almost like there was a spiritual element of like, see, I can be disciplined. You know, there would be temptations that you could resist. Judith Shulevitz wrote a great piece in the New Republic this week that, you know, makes the parallels between juicing and cleansing and religious fervor and religious practice almost. And you know, sees these juicing and cleansing texts as almost sort of, you know, religious texts. You can be tempted and resist temptation and feel good about yourself. So this was, I would say, about 20 years ago that I did this on a somewhat regular basis with colleagues. Other colleagues, co-workers at the time, would refer to these cleanses as planned eating disorders, which was not incorrect. And the fact is that now I've put on some weight and I do not feel comfortable doing it now because that feels unhealthy to do it to diet, which essentially I think it would be impossible to deny that that was a factor now because I do want to lose weight. And so I don't feel comfortable doing it now. And also, it does seem unhealthy and that in a way that, like, it's one thing when you're 30, but maybe not now. So I don't feel comfortable doing it now. But at that point when essentially it was kind of a lark, like when it's not a lark, it feels like it has a different kind of freight to it somehow.
So I have done a juice cleanse in the, like, most gross, commodified New York City Bloomberg era way, which is that a few years ago, I was living with a roommate who worked at a women's magazine, and she was writing an article about juice cleanses, and she was doing it. And she was actually really miserable on it. And I was like, I could do that. Like, but I actually, like, sort of had this competitive thing where I was like, if all these, like, you know, if all these ditzy girls can do this, I am so, like, I have more backbone than these girls. Not my roommate. She's great. But anyway, so it was, like, this total personal challenge. But then I paid so much stupid money to get, you know, you get these six juices a day, and it's a routine. They've got it all calibrated, so you're not...
Who's they?
Big juice. Big juice industrial complex. So I think I did the Blueprint Cleanse, which is sold at Whole Foods. Mm-hmm. It's, like, super yuppie and overpriced, but there are a bunch of these places now. Organic Avenue is really big, and it's pre-made. They've got a plan for you, so you, like, aren't totally starving even though your body is kind of hungry. And I actually really liked it. Like, I did it and I was like, oh, I'm just transformed. I have so much energy. I'm gonna eat so healthy now. And of course, you know, the next day I went to someone's birthday party and drank like a Bud Heavy at midnight. It was all over. Do you think that
is it about losing weight for a lot of people, or is it about moral discipline?
I think it's both. And yes, I think those are wrapped up so much right now. As June said, it's kind of embarrassing to admit sometimes that you want to lose weight. So you wrap it up as like, oh, I'm getting in touch with my body and cleaning out the toxins. And I think that is part of it, actually, for a lot of people. Like, I really did like the way I felt, and my skin did look better and all that stuff. But I would be lying if I didn't say that I did it because, like, I thought it would be like a super easy way to lose 5 pounds, you know? It's like, right. And I think in Vanessa's piece, she even says this, that it's people who are, you know, like, if you have a really perfect diet in general, like you eat you balance meals all the time and you don't have a sweet tooth, that you don't drink too much, whatever, you don't crave juicing, you don't crave this, like, quick fix. This, like, it's people who are given to extremes maybe who mm-hmm. like it. I don't know.
Uh-huh. So I read this in 2009. I read this essay by Mary Eberstadt called "Is Food the New Sex?" Which is something that, you know, Judith Shulevitz picks up on in the essay you wrote, and it kind of made it very difficult for me to participate wholeheartedly in the foodie movement. You know, because I am like fundamentally a foodie. Like I mm-hmm. shop at the whole, you know, I shop at the farmers market. Like I cook a lot. I eat a lot of vegetables. But her point was, and I think the losing weight thing you're talking about plays into this, that we have imbued, in an age when faith is declining, particularly among the elites, we have imbued food with a kind of morality. So, you know, there's the spiritual transcendence aspect of juice. There's this idea that losing weight is a moral virtue. Like it's not about, you know, just looking good and you know,
or
she says,
healthy.
Yeah, being healthy. So she says she describes a person in this situation. She believes to the contrary, there's a right and wrong about these choices that transcends any individual act. She believes that the world would be a better place and individual people better off if others believed as she does. She even proselytizes such an occasion when given the chance. Now, normally that sentence would be used to describe an evangelical, right? Like that would be someone who is talking about Jesus, not about juice. And now it's somebody who talks about food. And so this idea that we are morally superior, particularly since the foodie movement is completely a social class divided phenomenon, unlike religion, which is not a social class divided phenomenon. Like upper class people eat in certain ways and the other people eat in other ways. It just makes it really, really hard for me to kind of go there anymore, you know?
Right.
Although I will admit, here's how I use juice. My closest friend, I pick up her daughter every morning, so like I'm in her house a lot in the morning. She has one of those veggie $400 situations.
Oh, Vegemix.
Yeah, Vegemix.
No, Vitamix.
Vitamix to mix your veggies.
Yeah. So she makes me a juice every morning. And so the one way in which I participate in the juicy culture is like it's a novel way to eat vegetables. Like just that's all. I have no spiritual transcendence. I can't say I feel better. It's just like kind of cool that in the morning I'm eating like a pound of spinach with ginger and pear and like lime. And it's like the most delicious thing ever. Like those green juices to me are I'm a diabetic.
Okay, you
too,
are
so like
But you are.
But I just think it's delicious.
Yeah, but now you sound like a juicer.
Yeah,
you totally. So
damn it.
No, you totally do. So I did this crazy cleanse thing a few years ago. But like, that's not a lifestyle, you know. There's a really bougie coffee shop in my neighborhood that sells Swedish coffee and juices for like $9. And if I like really want to treat myself, I'll get a green juice. Like it's like a treat now. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing. It's like a cool way of getting vegetables. And I like drink it and I think I'm going to be so much healthier. And you're doing the same thing.
No, I don't think I do think I'm going to be healthier, but I don't like think other people who are not drinking it are lame or that it's like transcendent. It's just healthy. Is that okay? Like that's a little line for me to cross. Like I go no further than that. It's not like proselytizing juice. So, okay, I participate in that little way. Like,
so the
and I do think
won.
They're it has no sacrificial aspect. Like, I think they're delicious. Is that just not believable?
To me,
like,
that's worse. Because
damn it,
because there's at least kind of a purpose, you know, and there's all this, you know, you can
shit.
You're sort of letting go of shame and you're kind of working through all things, all these sort of ritual elements to the cleansing and the, you know, the kind of making a religion of it. You casual juicers, you're just like, I don't know, you're just like playing at it. You're the ones who should feel shame.
Damn it. I was feeling so good about myself. Like I was just about to spend that $400 and get my own damn juicer. And
well,
now I have to rethink this whole scenario. Like I, you know, I'm not trying to lose weight. I'm not trying to have transcendence. I'm just drinking juice.
It is
okay.
So expensive, though. It's like even if you do it at home, right? Like people buy these $400 blenders so they can save money and do it at home. But then the amount of produce that you have to buy is like insane.
Yeah.
You know, it and yeah, it's super healthy, but do you need to be that healthy? Like, can't you just have a salad? I don't know.
Well, that's part of the problem is like you read this stuff about the enzymes and this and that. It's like just eat some fruit and veg. Like I do that anyway, right? Like just eat a pear on your way to work. Like it's probably not that much worse, right? Like
No, it's better actually because you get the fiber in by eating real vegetables. Back to the world of dieting. When trying to lose weight, you're told not to drink juice because it doesn't fill you as much and you should be having all the fiber. There's these kind of religious fervor beliefs and then I'm not sure that they're always actually based in fact.
Well, that's like
right, because the other problem is when I do drink this juice at my friend's house, I'm really hungry by the time I get home from dropping off the kids. It's like I have to make myself like a peanut butter sandwich. So I don't really know what I've accomplished. I used to just eat like, you know, yogurt, nuts and an apple or something. And that like kept me going till 2:30 in the afternoon. So maybe healthy. I haven't accomplished very much.
So in the same issue of New York Magazine, there was also a piece about something called Soylent. Did you guys read that?
I did not read that.
So Soylent is it's kind of, I've never seen it in the wild nor tasted it, but it sounds like turbocharged like protein juice or whatever. It's some Silicon Valley programmer who has created, you know, this thing where you get all of your nutrients. It's all you ever drink and you can live on it, which sounds awful. And so, wow. But is that like the, is there like a male version of juice? Like, I know a lot of guys who juice actually. but maybe that's, you know, my
oh yeah. No, okay. David's totally much more manorexic than I am. Like, he has naturally, even before foodie culture, moral ideas about food that, like, you know, you eat food as a reward for certain things that you've done in a disciplined way. Like, I don't have any of that ideas at all. Although I am doing one weird food thing, which is this juicy friend of mine convinced me to try that Mark Bittman vegan before dinner thing.
Oh, people in my office are doing that. It's so annoying. No one ever wants
really
to go to good lunch places.
Right. It's really hard because, like, you can't eat yogurt. You can't have I don't know. It's kind of a pain in the butt. And you end up eating, like, a lot of carbs, which is no good for my diabetic self. Anyway, okay, enough of our personal food eating habits.
I think I'm tempted to try it again, though.
Yeah, let's go get a juice after this.
Let's go cleanse.
Yeah.
Okay, our third topic, the rise of the lady business traveler, such as me. This is an entirely self-involved, selfish topic that is designed entirely to ease my anxieties about getting on a plane for 20 hours this afternoon. The fastest growing segment of the traveling population are women business travelers. The entire travel industry has shifted in order to accommodate them. So hotels are scrambling to come up with new rules, such as, for example, not saying your room number out loud, but writing it down on a piece of paper and passing it to you. There are all sorts of social media companies that are rising now so that you can share travel options with your friends. So if you're going to the Bahamas, you post it and you get all kinds of information from your friends about their trip to the Bahamas. And women are essentially changing the travel industry. Now, on the other hand, we recently ran on the Double X blog this idea that everyone, men included, prefer to sit next to women on the plane for all sorts of reasons, because women take up less room, because they're nicer, because they'll keep your elbows off your seat. So I will say, are either of you anxious business travelers? Do either of you get really nervous when you go on a plane?
No, I love it. I like sleep like a baby on a plane. So
really? Even with no medication? No,
oh,
like
yeah.
Sleeping pills?
I literally am like a baby. Like, if there's motion, I will like conk out. It's great.
Wow. I don't have that ability. In fact, the opposite. I find it impossible to sleep on planes. However, I don't have any anxiety. However, I should kind of pull that back and say that I do sometimes find myself like choosing not to go out at night or maybe stay in or... But, you know, I'm kind of a stay in and watch TV person anyway. So
do you eat alone? Like, the things that a woman business traveler faces, like one study I read said that women are much less likely to eat alone because they feel it's self-conscious and violates the norms about women. Like, a man can eat alone and that's fine. But if you see a woman eating alone, you think there's something wrong with her. And that's weird.
I have absolutely no problem with it. I do it all the time. But it's also, I think, that's something that's changed a lot. I mean, I remember when I first came to America, I was in New York and I was eating on my own, and I was very young at the time. I mean, I think it was maybe 18 or something. And this guy asked the waiter to ask me to sit with him, which just to me was the weirdest thing. But I think at the time that was very normal. You know,
what do you
I guess,
mean he asked you to sit with him?
He asked the waiter to ask me if I would join him and eat at his table, kind of thing. And, you know, I guess have
wow.
conversation. And I think at that point, that's a long time ago now, I think that was fairly normal. That would never happen now.
Hey, this is Chris Wade, the engineer. I'm just popping in for 2 points by request.
Do you prefer to sit next to women or men on an airplane?
That's what I was asked to come in and talk about. When given the option and when traveling, I would almost always sit next to a single man than a single lady because I do not want to be perceived as imposing or threatening or creepy. So if there's a open seat next to a guy or an open seat next to a girl, I will choose the guy.
Can I just say that, like, you don't come across as imposing or threatening and creepy. And there are a lot of people who will sort of sit next to you on a plane who do sometimes come across that way and will take up your... And so it's kind of annoying that, like, the person who, like, maybe would not creep you out.
Yeah, well, that's the thing about creepy guys is that they ruin everything for the rest of us.
Right.
But, Chris, you're also choosing to have less space for yourself,
right?
Because... I mean, it makes sense in a way. It's just common sense that women use up less space typically. So
I'm 6'3", $2 and a dime. I'm used to not having enough space for myself. It's really not a problem. I'm going to be cramped no matter where I sit in a plane. The other thing I wanted to say is that about eating or dining alone, traveling, I think it might be weirder for girls than for guys, because if you are like at a bar alone as a dude, you can pretty much assume you will never be approached. Just sitting there. If you're at a bar as a girl alone, you can pretty much assume that eventually somebody will approach you.
That's why it's more awkward, because you can't, even if you feel like, I just want to have this alone time and enjoy this like tremendously wonderful meal or just have a drink by myself, it's not going to work out that way.
But you can, I don't know, I think you can shut people down pretty quickly if you are so, if you, you know, just want to be alone reading. I don't know. I've done a little bit of business travel in the past few months, and maybe just because it's novelty for me and I like don't have children at home who I have to worry about, but it's really, it feels very glamorous to just either, like, even if you just like go to your room and watch some really dumb television and order a glass of wine, that feels kind of glamorous. It's exciting for me, like in a very old fashioned, like I'm like a career woman, like, you know, like I'm going to make an expense report later, you know, so I don't have a lot of anxiety about it. Personally, but you said that you do in the beginning of the show.
Me, I have anxiety about it only because I'm going to be on the other side of the world from my children. I generally don't have anxiety about traveling alone. Being alone is such a rare occurrence in my life these days that, you know, even I was on a flight to Korea when I was reporting my book, and, you know, I was on that flight for 13 hours. And I have to say, like, I wrote an entire chapter of my book on that single flight, like with no distractions or like I guess I don't know how to relax. So maybe that's the problem. like it was pretty, you know, awesome.
I have to say that is the one thing that I absolutely adore about planes, is that they're maybe the last frontier. Planes and showers are like the last frontier where you can't be interrupted. Nobody can call you. You can't check your email.
Haven't you seen Psycho?
and so you, I mean, that is the best place for writing, for concentrating, for thinking. I do love that aspect of plane rides. And even though it's not that different when you're traveling with someone, because nobody really, I think, wants to talk for 13 hours. And also there's kind of a social, you don't want to be keeping the other people awake or bugging other people by talking for 13 hours. So even if you're not quite on your own, as long as you don't have kids, you can still read and write and do all those things. But that is an awesome aspect of travel.
I do think there's something different about traveling alone for business and traveling alone for pleasure. And I don't know if this has to do with me being a woman or not, or just, you know, my personality, but I have never really done much traveling on my own for fun. Mm. And I think I'm scared of that. I went to Russia this spring with my little sister, and because of the way flights worked out, I was alone in Moscow for 36 hours, which was actually kind of cool. But I, you know, I didn't do a lot of things that I would have done, and that, you know, Moscow, like a particular kind of city, maybe in other cities it would have been different. But that's actually something I'm a little sad about for myself, is that I haven't done that thing where I just like go for 2 weeks and travel alone. Because I think, you know, the Hairpin, I believe a couple of years ago, was running a bunch of essays on women traveling alone, and it just seems really freeing. Mm-hmm. June, you've done a lot
I
of
have.
That, right?
No, not, I mean, but I have, and I've you know, gone and I've traveled around on my own, and I've also just gone and moved to a foreign country on my own on different occasions. Also, I'm an only child. I'm a little bit antisocial, a little bit reclusive. I like being on my own. I know there are certain people who really don't like it at all.
Mm-hmm. Eat, pray, love, ladies. You gotta eat, pray, love.
Right.
You know, travel alone and you too can make millions of dollars with a best-selling memoir.
Was there, I wonder if there was like a rise in women traveling alone. There had to be, right, after that memoir. But like not even just to like Bali or whatever, although that made me want to go to Bali. But there had to be, like, I'm sure the travel industry had conferences on like how to lure in the woman traveler and how to like,
right.
How to capitalize.
Oh, yeah. I was recently at such a conference. That is absolutely true. Well, listeners, you can tell us if you travel alone. Tell us your woman traveling alone stories, if you felt vulnerable, if you felt empowered, what it was like for you as a woman to travel alone. Sorry, guys, there'll be a different topic for you. Okay, well, let's wind it up. Go to our recommendations. June, why don't you go first?
I want to recommend a really fascinating book called Hunting Season, Immigration and Murder in an All-American Town. It's by Mirta Ojito, O-J-I-T-O, and it's about the murder in Pachogue, Long Island in 2008 of Marcelo Lucero, who was an Ecuadorian, one of a community of Ecuadorians that had grown quite quickly in this Long Island town, was a very separate community. So it's a very sort of reasonable, very sort of balanced reported story that kind of breaks down both the place, the kind of international forces that lead to undocumented workers crossing borders, going to the state, what kind of people do it, what happened in this particular situation, what it means that more and more immigrants are going directly to suburban communities rather than the old pattern of moving to cities, and also the kind of the growth of the Latino population in the U.S. Just a really good read, very, very reasonable, very little polemic, none at all, in fact, and just a really great book.
That sounds great. My once somebody I admire, who was a friend of mine at the Washington Post, Ann Hull, when this trend first became noticed, did a series of pieces about immigrants moving straight to the suburbs, one of which was about a Dairy Queen in the South. And it's like one of my favorite pieces ever written anywhere. It's really a wonderful story. So my recommendation, I'll go next. If you have not read Dahlia Lithwick's piece about the Axe Challenge, about trying on Axe fragrance for a week and seeing how people reacted, many people did read it, but if you haven't, you should. It's truly, truly hilarious. And my second recommendation is, all of you parents, give Halloween back to the children. That's my recommendation. When I was a kid, Halloween was about us marauding, throwing eggs, you know, hitting people with water, and generally being wild, because for the other 364 days we were good. And now Halloween has become a Martha Stewart holiday, which is all about adults, you know, turning their houses into giant arts and crafts project. And on behalf of the children, I feel resentful of that. So let your children free. Let them go wild on Halloween and don't steal their holiday. That's my recommendation. Noreen.
Well, first of all, I want to support that. I also think I'm going to sound really fuddy-duddy here, but I'm sort of at an age where no one has kids, but we're like a little too old to like really, you know, party like we're 23. and people still have these stupid Halloween parties that I don't want to go to, and I don't want to like there's just something weird about the like prolonged adolescent celebration of Halloween before people start decorating their houses. Ban Halloween for people over 20.
I was thinking 10, but okay.
10. All right. You gotta let people do the slutty nurse thing for like a little bit. I have two. The first one is a quick Tumblr that has been making the rounds. Have you guys seen selfiesatafuneral.tumblr.com? It's really like hilarious. It's all of these teenagers hashtagging themselves, taking pictures of themselves in the bathroom mirror at funerals, or even like a selfie with the casket in the background, and it's like RIP grandma, like hashtag sad, and they're like, they've got a grin on their face, or they're like, you know, they're posed with their big back arch, and they're like, yeah, or like a peace sign. It's really funny, maybe alarming, but mostly funny, I think. And then the other is this album that I can't stop listening to by Patty Griffith. Are you a Patty Griffith fan? She's like a singer-songwriter in the, you know, Emmylou Harris kind of folksy, twangy kind of school. And it came out this year, I think in the spring or so, called American Kid. And it's a tribute to her late father. And it's just, it's beautiful and catchy and sad and lovely. And so it's on Spotify.
Well, thank you to Chris Wade for engineering this podcast. June Thomas, who's going to produce the podcast this week. Thank you to all our listeners. As usual, please join us on our Facebook page, which is Facebook.com/XXMag. I realize that for all this time, I've been just saying our Facebook page, but we generally are more likely to read comments if they're on the XXMag Facebook page rather than the separate GabFest Facebook page. So just wanted to say that because I haven't. Thank you to Andy Bowers, who is the executive producer of all the Slate podcasts. As always, please send us recommendations of what to talk about, and we will talk to you in a couple of weeks.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.